Welcome everyone to the Caribbean Science Fiction Network, a celebration of all things fantasy, folklore, speculative fiction, and of course, science fiction. Today it's part two of my chat with Imam Baksh from Guyana. We're talking about his novel, The Dark of the Sea.
The idea that drove the book forward was, what if you have this character who lives in a world where everyone around him thinks that there is no point to life, and he meets the ultimate manifestation of that idea, Lovecraftian God, where he is physically confronted with the idea that I am insignificant to the world, to the cosmos. Can he find a meaning to his life? Can he find a reason to say, yes, I'm going to stand up and live? And so that drove the book forward. So Lovecraftian gods were at the center.
So Imam, when we last talked, we left on the note of how you were able to capture Guyana and East Indian identities in the novel. Let's move from that into the overall world that you're building, which Guyana is a part of. And in the novel, there are references to Medusa. So
you're bringing together Hindu gods and Lovecraftian myths. So what about this combination you wanted to highlight?
All right. So I mentioned that the genesis of this book was that I wanted to take a kid who is in the worst Guyana has to offer in a way and have something wonderful happen to them.
Yeah.
So the next step was for me to say, well, what is his struggle going to be? It can't just be one all wonderful and happy. It's a novel. He's got to struggle. He's got to have a fight. It's YA. It's got to have action.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I was writing this book right after Guyana was announced to be number one in suicide in the world by the World Health Organization. There is an issue where they may have counted the numbers using a different methodology that year, and maybe yeah. We weren't as high as we should have been, or we were higher than we should have been. The point is, we have never been out of the top 20. We have always had a horrible suicide problem. And the Essequibo Coast, where I live, is one of two hot spots for this. And growing up, I would have this experience. It's mentioned in the book, Danish thinks about the fact that, yeah, about once or twice a year, you'll wake up and you'll hear that, oh, you're having breakfast conversation with your family and some neighbor is telling you, yeah, you know, somebody killed themselves last night, they drank insecticide. And it just felt like a normal part of the world. And that, when I went back to America, when I went to America and then came back to Guyana, and then the announcement that we were number one kind of shook us up as a nation. And it kind of galvanized us to say, hey, you know, we do actually have a problem. We weren't as complacent about it anymore. Mm-hmm. So I knew I was going to be writing about Danish's world. And I mentioned the Indianness of that world and all that. But the aspect of living in a depressed society where suicide is so common, you can't ignore that either. Mm-hmm. And then I was also reading a lot of Lovecraft at the time. And one of the central ideas in Lovecraft's world, which the other people that wrote with him in that world addressed, is that we don't live in a world that has a purpose. Humans are not the central being of the universe. Most religions will say God created man to be a servant. The earth was created for humans. We are custodians of the earth. You know, this kind of worldview that existed all the way up to the 1900s, where humanity is master of the earth. Lovecraft flipped that on its head. Lovecraft said, you are worse than an insect to the real powers of the universe. The universe is not hostile to you. The universe is not caring or nurturing to you. The universe doesn't even know you exist. What you do or don't do doesn't matter. You don't even comprehend the true nature of the universe because you are such a lowly creature. So cosmic indifference, sometimes referred to as cosmic horror. It's often thought that one of the reasons Lovecraft's horror felt so fresh is that he isolated this idea of living in a world that was so incomprehensible and meaningless to humanity. That's the true horror. It's not the tentacles. Mm-hmm. It's not the teeth, you know. And I felt these two ideas went really well together thematically. A person who commits suicide feels that they are not significant and there is no meaning. And it ties back to the idea that Lovecraft puts into his mythos, that humanity is indeed not here for a purpose. So the idea that drove the book forward from that point was, what if you have this character who lives in a world where everyone around him thinks that there is no point to life, and he meets the ultimate manifestation of that idea, a Lovecraftian God, where he is physically confronted with the idea that I am insignificant to the world, to the cosmos. Can he find a meaning to his life? Can he find a reason to say, yes, I'm going to stand up and live? And so that drove the book forward. So Lovecraftian gods were at the center. And then, of course, we come to the specifics of the character. If Danish is going to be a boy from the Eskimo Coast who is in a Hindu family, I wanted to energize his culture, his traditions, his knowledge. You know, you had Brandon O'Brien here talking about putting Caribbean people into Lovecraft as a way of empowering the Caribbean identity. Saying, hey, you know, the example he gave was Cthulhu asking a black rapper for his autograph. That if you can earn the respect of Cthulhu, that means that you have made the universe notice you. So if I was going to have an Indo-Guyanese boy going up against this thing, I have this thing I do in my fiction where I try to universalize the mythology of the world. You know, Children of the Spider mixes Anansi with Greek spiders. I have to be careful though, right? Because when you say, and I've had Hindu readers question me back on this, you know, the idea that you may end up equating Hindu gods, who are gods worshipped by people today, with mythology or superstition or fantasy. I don't want to do that. The idea is that if Lovecraftian gods existed, what would the Hindu gods' relation to them be? That is the idea. It's not to say that I'm equating them. But there are other mythologies that I have Danish encounter. And that's part of the process, very deliberate process, where I say Danish is discovering the world outside of his limited worldview. And so I start showing him stories from around the world. Now, he's already interested in epic stories from his time in the temple. It's one of the few sources of joy in his life. So I kind of break that open. So when he goes to the world under the ocean, he starts to encounter tales of the Sun Wukong, the Chinese, the monkey god, who is someone he identifies with. That's kind of underdog with a mischievous spirit, I think, is almost like his totem animal in a way. But we have the Cyclops from Greek mythology. He encounters Sedna, who is an Inuit god, but she's often equated with the gods of the Middle East, specifically Tiamat. I'm not sure how concrete you can connect Sedna to Tiamat, but I have seen people say, oh, they're both sea goddesses, they're kind of equivalent. So in the book, I have the Tablet of Destinies, which is a real thing from ancient Iraqi mythology. And Sedna is the keeper of the Tablet of Destinies that Danish is sent to recover. So these different mythologies all existing together, and they're connected by the ocean of the dream tide, it's called in the book, where all traditions kind of exist simultaneously but separately. It's a bit of a wonky concept. It's kind of like, it feels a little too meta at times, I feel. But that's how I made it work out. So we have all these mythologies all these traditions connecting together. And it's partly a way of saying to Danish, hey, your world is humongous. Your scope as a person to explore and experience things is really wide. And so that's why you get this juxtaposition of Lovecraft, Hindu gods, Chinese gods, Inuit gods, etc.
When he encounters these various, these mythological creatures, we get snippets of conversations around race, but it's not focused on it. So we have like the red skin Abyssians versus blue skin. Then we have a very brief conversation about dark skin versus light skin Indians. So talk to us about racial differences, which, I mean, it wasn't very deep, but you did touch on it in a way. So why?
It's mostly a world-building element. We know that in the Caribbean and Guyana specifically, there is a racial tension issue, yeah. Especially around election time, it can flare up. But even leaving that aside, within the Indian community itself, there is a colorism issue. And this is true in India, among Indians from India, who live in New York, Guyanese of Indian descent who live in New York, Guyanese of Indian descent who live in Guyana. It's something that we deal with as an Indian culture, colorism, this idea of dark skin being ugly, light skin being, you know, pretty or whatever. And you have people like Priyanka Chopra talking about being proud to be a brown girl, but in India she's advertising these skin dyes that are actually very caustic and dangerous, medically dangerous. You know, it's a billion-dollar industry. It's not that I'm trying to preach a message, and that's one of the reasons I don't go deeply into anything like this, because I don't want to be preachy. Yeah. But it is world building, and I'm telling the story of Danish's world. This is an element of Danish's world, and specifically the female characters are the ones who kind of address this, because they're the ones who are usually the victim of it. And at the time, I decided to name the fair maid Medusa. Of course, not the original Medusa. She's named after Medusa. And that's a bit more world building. You know, like if you take somebody like Alexander the Great, you go into Central Asia, Alexander is thought to have been some kind of servant of the devil who came from the West and invaded the lands. He's seen as a villain. But in the West, Alexander is one of the most popular names. We name people for Alexander. So imagine somebody from Central Asia who thinks of Alexander as this demonic conqueror comes to England and meets an Alexander. Like, why are you named after Alexander? This person is horrible. It's a perspective issue, right? So my character Medusa is named in honor of the monster Medusa, but she makes a side comment to Danish that you don't know the whole story. And one of the versions, now the Medusa story changes. It's got 1,000 years of change within the Greek and Roman worlds. And there are earlier versions of the Medusa legend where one of the issues is her dark skin, that she used to be fair skinned and she was proud of her fair skin. And one of the punishments when she was turned into a monster was she was blackened. And she was so upset at being blackened that she decided to start eating men. She wasn't eating them out of hunger. She wasn't eating them out of, specifically that she was upset that she was turned ugly by being blackened. That's what made her start hunting men. So that's something that came up to me. So when I came up with the character of this fair maid, I knew I wanted something that felt fantastical. It was not going to be the mermaid of Disney. This was going to be a creature that felt Caribbean. It was going to feel almost alien. So I came up with the jet black, blue black skin right away. That had to be there. This metallic silvery hair. And I was deliberately putting metallic silvery hair because I did not want it to feel like I was creating an Africanized or Indianized mermaid. It was something separate from humanity. So I had to make it so exotic. And so the dark skin of the character came first. And then coming up with the name, I had come across this version of the Medusa tale where her being dark skinned was a big issue. So I put those things together and I said, okay, she's named Medusa. And when Danish, who comes from Guyana, which is a place where skin color is a big deal from time to time, he would meet her, this is going to be an interesting clash for him. And I had to establish the light skin, dark skin thing in his environment, his home environment, his school, because I wanted the reader to understand where he was coming from when he bumped into Medusa. And there is this black skinned creature where he comes from a culture where there is a bias. In terms of the underwater world having people with different skin color, again, it's more world building. It is a scientific reality that creatures that live deep in the ocean are red-skinned. And the reason for that is that the light down there is mostly blue. So if you are red-skinned, you become kind of invisible. It's a good camouflage to be red if you live down in the abyss. So the Abyssians who live in the abyss are red-skinned. So it's kind of like a biological world-building thing, sci-fi getting into there. And the mermaids with the lightest blue skin live in the shallowest water where there is a lot of blue light. You know, it makes sense if you don't think about it far too deeply. Ultimately, one of the reasons that I have that separation, though, is I was going to do a female-centric civilization. The leader is female. Everyone on the council except for one person is female. Mm-hmm. There is a princess in the other settlement, the other city, Bejara. The princess comes over. She is female. It's a heavily female split. It's not 50-50 male-female. Most of the people in this society are female by population. And we have female soldiers, female engineers, researchers. So I wanted to establish a kind of female-led society, but I did not want to come across as someone who was idealizing a female-led society and saying, hey, you see, the world would be better if women were in charge. That's not my thing. And also, you want it to feel real. That's always a concern when you're world-building. Sci-fi, fantasy, it's a great concern for a writer. You always want this thing to feel, with at least at the surface level, you want it to feel like a place that could exist. I mean, pretty much any sci-fi or fantasy, if you dig deep enough, you can upturn that world building and say it doesn't make sense. But, you know, your first read through, you're like, yeah, this is a place that could exist. Mm-hmm. So there needs to be political conflict. These women cannot be a hive mind. They cannot be all united in harmony because that feels unrealistic. And also it's a disservice to the idea of a female-led society, I think. You want to have a society where, A, they have faults, B, they have disagreements, and C, they have a civilized way of settling their disagreements. So that scene at the council, where you can see the various agendas on display because of geography, skin color, gender, it all kind of interplays there. They're trying to figure out what to do with Danish, the leaders of this society. And that skin color helps to code the agendas in a way so that we get a believable world with real politics that seem real. And also that you're trying to figure out, well, what are they going to do about him? Are they going to imprison him and never let him home? Are they going to execute him? Are they going to, like, you know, it creates that sense of suspense as well. There is something that happened in Children of the Spider, right? There's a scene where the two main characters come to the city and they meet the third character who is kind of a main character. He's and he's a street kid. And Rafik, and I describe him as, I describe his skin color. And there are a few other places in the books where I describe skin color. And my Jamaican editor said to me, you know, this thing is not coming across too nice. You sound like you're a little too concerned about skin color. Like there's an issue you have. And I think she was missing the Guyanese context, which is, and the Indian context too, which is that people will treat you differently sometimes based on the lightness of your skin. And so it's one of the first things people notice about you is that shade of you. So I was trying to portray the Guyanese mindset, where as a Guyanese reader, you would understand if somebody is described as dark skin, that there is a certain social struggle they have in their life automatically. Or light skinned, you would understand that there's a certain social privilege that comes with that. And to me, it was just a way of saying to the reader, especially a Guyanese reader, hey, this is what this person's situation in life is. And I would never do that, of course, if there were not actual consequences to skin color in Guyanese society, but there are. I don't want to make it sound dire. It's not at all dire, but it's one of those things that comes up. It's less an issue now than ever before. I'm happy to say that. My father's generation, my grandfather's generation, the darkness of your skin was a big deal. My father, as a child, was told he couldn't play outdoors because he would get too dark. You know, and when I was a child, I had no clue that anybody had any concern like that. Nobody told me anything. I ran around in the sun all day long as much as I could. And nobody ever said, oh, you need to preserve the color of your skin or anything like that. So we're much better with it now. But it's something I wanted to show. But after she said this to me, my editor, I realized that I have to restrain myself. So one of the things when I got into this skin color politics of Dark of the Sea, I had to say, okay, I'm going to mention it's there. I'm going to show some of the surface effects, but it's all just going to be kind of on the surface.
Now, Imam, we're coming down to the end of the chat. But let's talk about the end of the novel for those who haven't read. I mean, we can talk about it in a general sense because you do give it does end on a really positive tone. So talk to us about the novel's ending, almost a life lesson. So explain it to us in terms of what you set out to do or what you set out to do in general as a writer, as a Caribbean writer as well.
Well, I talk about the suicide issue and how that's paired up with the challenge of this Lovecraftian god. You cannot win against a Lovecraftian god. I wanted that to be an absolute bedrock principle of this book. This is not going to be a story where the hero gathers these magical items and at the end slays the monster. It cannot work. That's against the very principles of Lovecraft. And it would be disrespectful to that mythos to have that happen. And it's reflective, you know, of the idea of the purpose of your life. You live in a world where you will die. You face death. You live in a world where you may or may not have a purpose that you feel in your life. And ultimately, if the Lovecraftian view is correct, you literally do not have a purpose to your life. So it's a parallel thing. You can never overcome death. Danish can never overcome the Thargo. It just, those two things are parallel ideas. And so if you start with the principle that Danish cannot overcome this cosmic purposelessness of his life, then the question is, but can he find a way to live in this situation? So without getting into what exactly happens at the end, there is no big beatdown of the ancient god. There is not. But there is a fight. There is a struggle. There is a climax that is fun and energetic. I don't want the reader to feel otherwise. But at the end of the book, we see Danish having found that purpose in his life, or at least the beginnings of it, where he says to himself, I want to live for me. I want to be a better person, or I want to see the world. I want to explore the world. I want to live in the world and experience it. And this is a very big change from the person we see at the beginning. At the beginning, he's a person who is hiding from the world. He's hiding from the pressures of authority figures. He's hiding from the idea of doing anything with his life. You know, he has his conversations with his best friend where his best friend is talking about going to get a job. and building a family. His best friend has ambitions to get married and stuff. And Danish is kind of stuck in second gear. He doesn't want to commit. He doesn't see a reason to commit to living life. Yeah. And by the end of the book, because of everything he's been through, he can say to himself, I am in this. I'm in this for me. And whatever may happen, whatever the struggles of the existential struggle of life is, I have a purpose that is mine. And I'm working towards it. And I know I'm going to get hit down, knocked back down to my knees at some point, but I'll get back up. I understand that. And a lot of where the ending of the book ultimately arrives, it's based on Albert Camus' essay, Sisyphus. And, okay. You know, Camus dealt with these issues of suicide. What is the existential purpose of life? We all die. Why do we bother to live? And in his essay, he comes up with this idea that, you know, Sisyphus was condemned to roll a rock up a hill and then it would keep falling back down. Ultimately, what comes out of Camus' consideration of these ideas is that just to spit in the face of futility, we live in this absurd life and we need to embrace that absurdity and basically tell it to get, to, well, I don't want to use the profanity, to F off, right? You got to spit in the face of the absurdity of life and say, hey, whatever you're doing, I don't care. I'm just here for the fun. That's how I would put it as a Guyanese. Of course, that's not a very philosophically friendly way of saying it. But that's kind of the point where Danish has arrived, where he's like, look, I'm going to keep pushing this rock. It's going to keep falling down. But it's what I have. And it's something I'm going to hold on to.
I feel that that could be a way to end our chat, but I'm going to give you one more chance. Anything else you want to say before we go?
Well, we got really deep here into what a writer tries to do to construct the book. And we got deep into themes and messages. And I don't want anybody to think this is a heavy book. This is a very fast-paced book. This is a very action-oriented book. This is a short book, 200 pages. And everything, these deep concerns are there if you want to look for them. But for the most part, what I have written is a book where I hope children, teenagers, people who like adventure fantasy can read it for a good adventure fantasy young adult experience. Something that at the beginning to end, you feel entertained.
So, Imam, I want to thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate the perspective, the all these themes that we have explored, but also everything packed into this really entertaining novel. So thank you very much.
You're very welcome. I'm happy to have a gap.
And to everyone listening, thank you as well. Continue to stay tuned to the Caribbean Science Fiction Network. Bye.